Got a sledge-o-matic with you?
I'm going to go with manual sledge-o-matics. Okay, Stephen, you mind starting us off with a word of prayer?
Yeah, let's pray together. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for this beautiful day, the good weather that we had today. Thank you for our jobs, our means to provide for our family, the blessings that come from that. And we thank you for this place that we have here together, to open your word and peace and comfort. We pray that the things that we study here tonight will be honorable to you and will reflect your desire for us. We will learn more about you as we study through the book of Samuel. We pray these things in your son's name.
So this is one of those lessons that Travis is getting back at me for saying that there wasn't a lot to talk about in a section by giving me two chapters that are redonkulously full of stuff. And so it's one of those things like I prepared the lesson and then I went back and I looked at it a few times and I sat down last night with my laptop just to sort of like review and maybe edit some of the stuff that I had to take out. And I kept finding more stuff to talk about. So my goal is to get to the end and I think I can do that. But like buckle up because it's going to be pretty quick. I'm going to try to be as fast as I can. And I texted Travis today. I was like, there's so much to talk about. And there's so much like that bears talking about because there's really neat connections in some of these chapters and like callbacks to other things we've already talked about and call forwards to things that we're going to talk about later. So we're in 1 Samuel 14 and 15. Sorry to get rid of that front. I do have the splash zone when I spit my gum out on accident. 1 Samuel 14 and 15. And so where are we? Like, tell me where we were Sunday morning. Where did we stop? Because this is very much a story kind of book. So I know Travis knows because he taught it. So, well, he said it. Did he teach it, though? Can you all remember? Sorry, it's...
We stopped on the simple sacrifice that Paul made.
Okay.
We shouldn't have done it.
Okay. And so the sinful sacrifice. Anything else we should remember from Sunday? I don't know. I'm just asking. Just... Yeah. Yeah, and what's interesting is we're gonna do that again. And it's actually not even just gonna be that, it's gonna be he's gonna refuse. Like it's like, okay, here's what I'm gonna do. You ever done like a kid gets in trouble and you punish them and then you realize, oh, I should probably punish you more, so you do even more. And we're gonna talk about that a little bit tonight too. So here we go. Once again, just a throwback to this one. All of the action we're gonna talk about today is gonna happen right here. So basically in Jefferson County. Okay, we're going to talk about that a little bit. I'm going to have some talk about a little bit of World War One actually, because there's a connection to World War One in this. And we're going to go from there. So chapter 14 is going to be Jonathan's victory, some oaths, and a sort of victory. Okay, and I'll talk about why it's just sort of a victory. Spoiler, it's Saul's fault that it's not a total victory, but we're going to get there. So Jonathan's victory is the first section, and that's going to be verses 1 through 5. So... Now the day came that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who was carrying his armor, "Come and let us cross over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Okay, so why? Why didn't he tell dad? Anybody got a guess?
Because Saul wouldn't want
him. Yeah, Saul would have shut it down real quick. Because what we're going to find out here in a minute is how many people are with Saul in this chapter right now? 600 with Saul, and we're led to believe by some of the explanation here is that Jonathan has some men too, right? Because he's with his people, Saul's with his people. I'll show you a map of that here in a second. And an outpost of the Philistines. This is not the main Philistine camp, okay? And we're going to talk about how we can tell that from some of the context clues that we get, how many people leave that army and come over, and how many people are with them and not with them and all that stuff. So it's probably an outpost. And there's also a little bit more there. So Jonathan had found a path between the camps. So the World War I connection is actually really interesting. World War I, a lot of people realize like, oh, the Western Front, Eastern Front, all in Europe, right? Well, a big chunk of World War I is fought in the Middle East, Lawrence of Arabia and all that good stuff. There is a British army officer who is putting siege to I don't know the exact name of the city, but there's a laying siege to something in the area of Michmash. I don't remember what the name of it. By the way, if you Google Battle of Michmash, you may get the World War I battle. You may get this battle. You got to make sure you're looking at the right ones, because as soon as they start talking about the British, I'm like, whoa, 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 that's not the right people. So what happens is this officer is sitting there, and he's like, how do we do this? How do we take this thing? And one of his lieutenants comes up and is like, hey, you remember Samuel chapter 14? There's a path here somewhere that leads around, like, that is an easy way to sneak up. And British Army legend says that they found, like, a little hidden path that they used to sort of come around the back end of Michmash instead of coming straight at it from the front like you normally would. And that's that unit's, like, flag now has Samuel chapter 14, like, Samuel 14 on it, or 1 Samuel 14 on there. So it's pretty interesting. So we've got false forces that are up at Migron. Why is it crest question mark? Not really sure where it is. Michmash is where the main Philistine groups are. And then the Philistine outpost is, they think, over here. So Sinna and Boaz, the way that reads is that it is a steep rock or a sharp rock, which gives us the idea that it's cliffs, right? So you got a cliff on one side, you got a cliff on the other side. And he finds sort of a secret way to do that. And so Jonathan's forces are here. In Gibeah of Benjamin, which is where we think it roughly is. So he comes around and works his way up. What do we call these little depressions? Because I'm a geography nerd. We would call it a valley. They would call it a holler. A wadi. A wadi is a seasonal creek, right? Or creek. So it is something that in the rainy season it'll flow. If not, it is pretty dry. I can't remember if I have a picture of it here. I don't yet. Oh. There it is. Yeah, so I went too far. This is, if you look back and you know how to read a map, this is standing about right here, shooting this way with the camera. Okay, so let me go back to it. So that's what it's meaning by steep cliffs. You'd imagine it'd be pretty simple to sort of crawl your way up. And it even says Jonathan did what? Crawled on his hands and his knees to it. So, yeah. So real quick, quick aside, because you know this book is telling a story and all of a sudden it'll hop over to somewhere else. I'm like, oh, by the way, in verse 2, Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah under the pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. And the people who were with him were about 600 men. So that's either a really big pomegranate tree or Saul was hogging the shade. And Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the priest of the Lord at Shiloh, was wearing an ephod. Some verses, does anybody's verses in verse 3 say carrying an ephod? Yeah, literally, like if you, some of the verses will say literally carrying. And some people, some scholars will say it is because the priestly idea has not really, like, still not there because of how bad it was under Eli's sons. Some people say carrying, some people say wearing. I tend to think, because of some of the stuff we're going to see later, that he would be wearing it and he is using the ephod as it is meant to be used. And that's sort of just one of those, like, people who have PhDs in Bible history will pick at that. But I don't think it really matters. But I really do think it that he's, who would be wearing. And the priest of the Lord at Shiloh was wearing an ephod, and the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. What's this tell us about Jonathan's goal here?
He wanted to act in secret.
Okay, he wanted to act in secret. He also isn't looking for the accolades of men, I think we can read that out of that. That if he really wanted to be like, hey, look, I'm going to go kick the donkey stuffing out these Philistines and we're going to do this, yay, yay, yay. This is more of him, and we're going to see some of his words here in a second, that it's him wanting to go out and do good work. Do good work for the Lord, not because it'll make him look good, which is going to be in direct contrast to some of the stuff we're going to see from Saul. This is one of those questions that I really couldn't come up with a good answer to. Why does the author here make a point to tell us that Phinehas, the son of Eli, is there? That why?
It's a contrast between Samuel. Samuel's the acting priest.
Yeah.
This is someone in the lineage of Eli who was cut off from the priesthood when Phinehas and Hophni died. So it's probably just a contrast between who Saul should be consulting.
Yeah. And what does the name Ichabod mean? Am I remember?
Headless.
Headless, yeah. The glory is departed. Yeah, the glory of God is gone. Is basically what it means. And I think including that name is what's important there. Is that they're saying, by the way, and anybody who understands what that name means would be like, ooh, that's one of those like little slights at it that that culturally we don't really get. We're like, oh, Ichabod, okay, great. The guy from Headless Horseman is not there, is there. But anybody who would be reading this at the time would have been like, I see something bad happening here. This is like, you got to do a damn. The God, glory of God's gone. Yeah, go ahead.
So I do think it's interesting. I don't know how much you know about like the symbolism and numbers and stuff. I've been told the number like six.
Yeah.
600 is kind of like an incomplete number. It's more Saul kind of trusting in himself. And I think that also goes along with the priest who's there.
Yeah.
Kind of call back to when they originally, you know, Hophni and Phinehas were out there when the Philistines originally took Ark,
yeah.
I think this is kind of like saying Saul's trusting in his own power. He's not putting his faith where it's supposed to be.
Okay, so real quick, I just want to have a reminder lesson, throw back to a while ago. How long was the ark gone from the Israelites?
7 months.
How long was it? Well, it was gone for 7 months. How long did it sit in Kiriath? I can't, 20 years.
Okay.
Think about that for, keep that in mind. Because there is a part that comes up later. I just want everybody to sort of keep that there. And specifically says he's carrying the ephod or has the ephod with him, right? Okay. So the action, 4:14 is where the action happens. Jonathan says, come, let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few. I like this verse. I like Jonathan's attitude here. He says, maybe God's going to work for us because it does. The numbers don't matter to him. We can do this, and we're going to go do this. We're going to try at least, okay? Which is going to be in a direct contrast to what his dad's going to pull in the end of this chapter, in the next chapter, and a whole bunch, pretty much for the rest of this book. First of all, the test. He said, we're going to sneak over there and we're going to show ourselves to this garrison. We're going to say, if they hail, and we're going to just stand up and let them see us. If they hail us, if they say, hey, come over here, and we're going to tell you something, we'll go to them. But if they don't say anything, what are we going to do? It doesn't really say, but I would assume that if they don't say anything, he's probably planning to run away, right? So what do the Philistines say to him in verse, let me go down to where it is. Verse 12, what does it say? Or 11, it starts, look, said the Philistines, the Hebrews are crawling out of the holes they were hiding in. The men of the outpost shouted to Jonathan and his armor bearer, come up to us and we will teach you a lesson. In another verse, this is NIV, in the NASB it says, come up, we have something to tell you. And I think that, what do you think they're going to tell him?
He's going to show you a thing.
He's going to show you a thing, yeah. Like my piece, yeah. Yeah, obviously, they do hail them, so what do? And I do want to put a little aside in this to Jonathan's armor bearer. I love his responses, because every time he's pretty much, I'm good with what you're good with. Let's go. Like, if you want to do it, do what is good for you.
I'm with you heart and soul.
Yeah, I'm with you heart and soul. Let's go. Let's do this. Yeah. And armor bearers back in the day, most of the time would have been bodyguards. So this isn't like just some guy who's carrying his armor. This is traditionally when an individual would fight, when a group fights, you fight in that phalanx formation that you see the Greeks do, not such a tight phalanx, but they would fight together, shields up, shield walls, all that good stuff. When an individual would fight, they would have a guy with them protecting them from the back, protecting them sides, keeping him protected. And so this isn't just some random guy carrying stuff. This is probably one of the better warriors, and he's the bodyguard of the king's son. And so that's going to sort of come in there a bit. So 14, that first slaughter, which Jonathan and his armor bearer made, was about 20 men within about a half a furrow and an acre of land. So what's a furrow? We always get all these, I love the measurement names. A half a furrow. A furrow was the amount of land two oxen could plow in a day, which is roughly an acre. So this is half a furrow, so that'd be half one oxen, you know, plowing in a day. And so that's what leads most historians and military historians to believe that this was just a small outpost. This would not be this full camp. And they go in, and the description of it is interesting. The Philistines fell before Jonathan, and his armor-bearer followed and killed behind him. In other translations, it says Jonathan knocked them over, and his armor-bearer killed them. So that's the idea of an armored warrior. Once they're down, you got them knocked over, the armor-bearer would come up and do the whole coup de grace and kill them while he's still fighting them off with however he was going to be fighting. Because remember, back to the verses a little bit, who has weapons in this army? Saul and Jonathan. The rest of them have mattocks. You know what a mattock is? It's a big hammer on one side and a pick on the other. I mean, I wouldn't want to get hit with that. Or they would have long poles with blades on them. I always think back to the movie Braveheart, where they have the guys that are standing there with their... they look like basically shepherd's hooks that they've just put pieces of metal on that have sharpened, and that's what their weapons are. But you can actually see some that they have some recreations of the weapons from that time period. It's pretty interesting. So... oh, I actually put that there. So that happens, right? So Jonathan gets in there. Jonathan is showing some really great qualities of a leader, which is interesting because of the juxtaposition of dad, Saul, who is making some terrible choices and doing some terrible, has terrible ideas all through, where Jonathan is successful. Yeah. Yeah. And there's some interesting like dig-ins to the Septuagint. By the way, just the Septuagint is a Hebrew translation of the Old Testament that is a little bit different than the Torah. I'm trying to think of the best way to word it. But it's a little bit different. It's got some extra stuff in it sometimes. There's a little bit like deeper dive into some of these more apocryphal texts that talks about why that is. Like the whole... where this all goes. That's a whole another class, talking about those different texts and the different historical resources we have. So the next section, verses 15 through 23, it's an earthquake, and everybody gets really confused, and some fancy stuff happens. Any points you all want to make? Let me make sure I didn't skip over some stuff. I'll just put my notes to sleep. Anybody? Nothing? Nothing? Okay, great. So there's an earthquake. Actually, sources will debate this, that it may have been, the way the wording is, it may have been an earthquake. It may have just been, it is a euphemism for all of the Philistines being so scared that the camps are shaking and quaking. I didn't find an argument that was definitive either way. I saw arguments that made sense that it was a miraculous earthquake. I saw arguments that it was the quaking of the armies. Both sides made sense. Once again, not a big deal either way. Same outcome. So, and there's a trembling in the camp, in the field, and among the people, even the garrison, and the raiders trembled, and the earth quaked so that it became a great trembling is one of the translations. Other ones leave out that whole, the earthquake. It'll say that the camps quaked or the lands quaked. While this is happening, Saul takes role. He says, okay, what's going on? That map, remember I showed you where Saul is, you can see the outpost, you can see the different places. He would have a vantage point. He says, nobody's missing, so take role. Once again, this is just showing that Saul has really bad perception problems when he's looking at groups of people. He just doesn't see the full numbers, and he's... So they take role. What do they find out? Jonathan's gone, right? And so let's look at verse 15. No, sorry. 16. Saul's lookout at Gibeah in Benjamin saw the army melting away in all directions. Then Saul said to his men who were with him, muster the forces and see who has left us. When they did it, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. Okay? So Saul said to Ahijah, bring the ark. Does anybody's say bring the ephod? Okay. This is where some historians will say the ark's not with them. The ark is in Kiriath there. That this is should actually say ephod. And there's going to be a couple things that are going to happen in the text that will show that it probably is the ephod and not the ark, because we know where is the ark? Yeah, and then also in Chronicles, it specifically says, David says, bring out the ark because we did not ever consult it in the days of Saul. And so that's where you're like, it's probably the ephod and not the ark. Okay.
Mine has a footnote. This is Septuagint says the ephod.
Correct. And that's the thing. The Septuagint has some different stuff. Now, you can actually dig into where they think, okay, how did it, that's one of the interesting things. How did this mistranslation or miswording happen? And man, you can find books about just this, where it's like, well, maybe this happened. Because in this copy, we have this. In the next copy, and we know this was in 1207, and we know this copy was in 1208, and they're different. So maybe this happened. It's pretty interesting, some of the stuff you can get. And these guys, who that's all they get paid to do, is like research these differences in text. It's really neat. So 1 Chronicles 13:3 says that they never consulted the ark. So that's what, and David says that. We never consulted under Saul, so we probably should do that, bring forth this. Yeah, so this is that verse. Let us bring the ark of our God back to us, for we did not inquire of it during the reign of Saul. What is he talking about? Bring it back to us from where? Where'd we say it's been for 20 years? Kiriath, wherever, yeah. And that's why people are, that's why they're saying that. So they consult, and what happens? So they bring the ark. While Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult in the Philistine camp increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, withdraw your hand, which is another surprising thing, because what are you not supposed to do to the ark? Touch it, right? So what he's probably talking about, if you know what the ephod is, it has the 12 stones for the 12 tribes, but it also has what's a little pouch. It's called the Urim and Thummim, right? One's a dark stone, one's a light stone. And what traditionally under Jewish culture is, if you pull out, you ask it a question, that's a yes or no. You pull out the white stone, it's a yes. You pull out the dark stone, it's a no. And so that's what they do. And so we'll talk about that a little more, because he's going to consult it again and not get an answer. And it's sort of interesting, like, how do you not get an answer to a yes or no question? So we'll talk about it there in a second. So Saul goes to battle. Starts in verse 20. It's going to say, then Saul and all his men assembled and went to battle. They found the Philistines in total confusion, striking each other with their swords. Those Hebrews who had previously been with the Philistines had gone up with them to their camp, went over to the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. When all the Israelites who had hidden in the hill country of Ephraim heard of the Philistines were on the run, they joined the battle in hot pursuit. So on the day of the Lord saved Israel, and the battle moved on beyond Beth Avon. This reminds me, I don't know how much you know about the battle of Lexington Concord, when the Redcoats retreat, all the militias are like, oh, okay, now they're running. They all like pile on them until they get back to Boston. That's sort of what I get the idea of here. As they're leaving, remember the Philistines said, hey, all these guys, oh, look, they're coming out of the holes they're hiding in. And so all these guys who have dispersed are there. So what I find interesting is Israelites fighting with the Philistines. Why? Correct. And so some of the translations will call them slaves or servants. Some of the translations, the historians will say that this is to show that Saul has still not solidified his role over the entire area of Israel, and that these are people from conquered areas that the Philistines have taken over, taking them in as levies or garrisons. So once they join them, how many do they have? That number's going to come up later. But you know it? I think I'm remembering correctly. I think it's in the slides later, but about 10,000. So that's not just a small group of Israelites that are helping. I mean, they go from, let's say Saul has 600, Jonathan has, there is no real way to know, but less than Saul. So you're looking at adding 9,000 people possibly to their garrison from the Israelites. So it's not a small chunk that aren't there, okay? So there's these oaths we're going to talk about here in a second. Verse 24, now the men of Israel were hard pressed on that day, for Saul had put the people under the oath, saying, cursed be the man who eats food before evening and until I have avenged myself on my enemies. What words do you see that sort of stand out to you? I put a little emphasis on them for you. Yeah, he's using, yeah, so when you teach kids to write in school, you tell them, like, when you're doing certain writing styles, you don't say I, me, we, you just write. You give facts and details. And so when I see me and my, I'm like, oh, who should he be saying here?
He's putting a lot of faith in himself.
Yeah.
The census of the army is another example of him weighing his own physical might and not leaning on God.
Yeah. And just the use of, I mean, the simple language, like I talked about it before in the class I taught in the auditorium, the idea of that language that you use means things. It has, like, it matters, the words you say. Instead of saying, I have to do something, I get to do something, right? Saying, until I have avenged myself, until we have avenged ourselves on God's enemies, just putting it into that context a little better. But it just also shows you, what about Saul?
The purpose is on him.
Yeah. Also, this is sort of a throwback to when, what did Samuel tell the people about having a king?
They're going to make you bend to their will.
You're yeah. They're going to bind you to oaths that you don't want to be bound to, and they're going to take your sons. Keep that in mind, because we're going to come up to that in here in a second. And so he's going to tell them that. And so that's just sort of like the little preface, because then it goes, so none of the, and then it says at the end of it, so none of the food, troops tasted food. So they're tired. They're hungry. Yeah, so Jonathan's going to break this oath. So they sort of like lay it out there, and it's like, but we know, and it switches scenes real quick. The entire army... people are running down the enemy and are hungry. The difference in mileage, it's about 8 to 10 miles, they think, that they're pursuing at this point. So some of the translations will say there's honey on the ground, which is sort of a divinely placed, some of the authors will say, yes, it was one of those like, hey, we're going to put honey there for them. Like a God is going to provide that sustenance that they need. Some say, no, that's just the wording that they would use where honey, like a honeycomb had fallen out of a tree and smooshed open, right? Does it matter? I don't think so. But what does Jonathan do? But it's interesting. He's a little prudent about it. He just doesn't walk over and gobble it all up. He walks in, sticks the end of his spear into it, and then brings it back and puts his hand to his mouth. And what do y'all's translations say happened to him? His countenance brightened. His eyes became bright. Anybody say that his strength was renewed? A couple of different translations will say that. Jonathan hadn't heard the oath. He reached out the end of his staff. He picked it up. Then one of the soldiers told him, your father bound the army under a strict oath, saying, cursed be anyone who eats food today. That's why the men are faint. And I think it's interesting that he didn't tell him while, like, when they see him walk over to a honeycomb to stick his stick into it and then eat it, while they weren't like, whoa, 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 like, stop for a second. I don't know. I think there's a lot you can read into that, but I think there's a lot you can't read into that, too. So, and then Jonathan said, my father has troubled the land. See now how my eyes have brightened because I've tasted a little of this honey. How much more if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found. For now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great. This is the first time we're seeing people do what to Saul since he's become king. Question is leadership. Like, you had the people early on that questioned it, but this is the first time somebody's openly saying, he's causing us problems.
Well, it's his own son.
It is his own son. And I think that, yeah. And we're going to see that here in a second when we get to this next section. So ultimately, Saul's oaths are going to have consequences. People are hungry, still hungry and working hard. They overrun the Philistines and eat the meat with the blood. So when they overrun some Philistines that have animals with them, they kill the animals right there and eat them because they're starving. Right? I did this 9-mile thing on Saturday and I probably would have like eaten a raw animal at the end of it. I was that hungry. I can only imagine doing it with weapons and armor and all that stuff, right? And killing people while I'm doing it. So they eat the meat with the blood. So not only did they break Saul's oath, what else did they break? God's law, because you're not supposed to eat the Israelites were not supposed to eat the blood. It's a kosher thing, right? And it all has to do with how you empty the blood out. So, I've got to put verses on this one. I like the way that it reads in this one. 32, they pounced on the plunder and taking sheep, cattle, and calves, they butchered them on the ground and ate them together with the blood, which is another way to say raw, most likely, because if you cook this stuff, the whole blood comes out. It's also how you let them drain. Then someone said to Saul, look, the men are sinning against the Lord by eating the meat that has blood in it. You have broken faith, he said. Roll a large stone over here at once. Then he said, go out among the men and tell them, each of you bring me your cattle and sheep and slaughter them here and eat them. Do not sin against the Lord by eating meat with the blood that is still in it. He doesn't even mention what? the oath, right? He doesn't even mention, oh yeah, and this is sort of my fault because I told him not to eat all day. Now, there is a debate, like you can get into personal responsibility versus following the oath of a leader, correct? And the best argument I saw said it was an unwise oath. It was hurting the people. So should they have been bound by that, or were they bound by it? So did the people sin by breaking Saul's oath, or did they sin because they ate the meat with the blood?
Yes,
I think it's a 6-1, half dozen another. And you're going to see some stuff come out of here in a second. So you have broken faith, he said. Yeah, so they sacrificed it. So everybody brought the ox that night and slaughtered it there. Then Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first time he had done this. Okay, I wonder if this is the first time he's done this. Because what have we heard that he's done before? Somebody said it. What did we leave off on?
Sacrifice.
The sacrifice that he wasn't supposed to give, which you would think would have been on an altar. So it's neat that it makes that distinction, right, between the sacrifice and the altar before to this one. How are we feeling on this one? Yeah, me too, man. So Saul's going to continue the pursuit, and he's going to make another oath. And so Saul said, and we're looking at verse 38, "Let us go down and pursue the Philistines by night and plunder them till dawn, and let us not leave one of them alive." And what do the people say? "Do whatever seems best to you," right? But the priest said, "Let us inquire of God." So Saul asked God, "Shall I go down and pursue the Philistines? Will you give them the Israel's hand?" But God did not answer him that day. So most likely, and what we know from some of the historical context of when the priest would consult the Urim and Thurim, the first thing they would ask is, "Are you going to talk to us today? Or are you going to give us, we are coming to you for an answer." There's a whole like little speech that they would give. "Are you going to give us your will?" Or something along those lines. And they'd reach in and pull out a stone. If it was white, they'd keep asking questions. If it was black, they'd be like, "Oh, he don't want to talk to us today. Put it back in." So that's what most of the historians will say, is that he wasn't getting an answer because they'd pull out, "Nope, nope, nope, nope." And they'd be like, "Is the white one even in there? Because we are going to inquire of that." And there is actually, there is a story from one of the, I think Josephus writes about it, where they did. They inquired of the Lord, and he said like 17 times, and it was always no. And it was interesting. And Josephus marks that down. It was a battle. I can't remember what battle they're inquiring about, but it was an interesting little side note there. So Saul therefore said, "Come, all you who are leaders in the army, and let us find out what sin has been committed today, and surely as the Lord has rescues." So he didn't answer him. Why didn't he answer him? I'm going to stop reading that for a second. Why do the people start to assume, or what does Saul assume actually too? He's not answering us because what? There's sin in the camp, right? Because that's normally when God doesn't talk to the Israelites, it's because there's sin. We're going to figure that out. So I saw this as I was working. This is like my favorite meme in a while, so I saved it. "For as the Lord lives who delivers Israel, though it is Jonathan my son, he will surely die." And the people are like, because do the people know what's up? Mm-hmm. Most likely, yeah, because they were with Jonathan. I thought that was great, so I had to throw that in there. So there we go. Saul's oath can have a little more consequences. And I saw Travis look at the clock, so I'm like, good. So they cast the lots. He's pretty sure it's not them, because Saul is positive that it's not him and Jonathan that have the sin. So he says, "You know what? Well, our first split is going to be me and Jonathan, and then y'all's over there. Now predict." And they pull it out, and they're like, "Oh, it's you two. That was quick. We don't have to split everybody 1,000 times to figure out who it is." Actually, I don't want to go to that yet. We're going to look at... So they go through the whole process, do what's best for you. Why have you not answered? They do all this stuff. "Tell me what you've done. I tasted a little honey with the end of my staff, and now I must die." Saul said, May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan. So he said, okay, I guess you got to die now. But then, who steps up? The people step up. And I can only imagine that they're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. This is not his problem. This is not an us problem. This is a you problem here. But the men said to Saul, "Should Jonathan die, he who has brought us this great deliverance in Israel, never, as surely as the Lord lives, not a hair on his head will fall to the ground, for he did this today with God's help." So the men rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death. Then Saul stopped pursuing the Philistines, and they withdrew to their own land. Or so it says here, Philistines went to their own place. line? No, no. Yeah. I think it's the juxtaposition between Saul, who was going to make excuses about everything under the sun, and Jonathan stepping up and being like, I messed up. I'm a man of my word. That was the oath. Let's go. Just do it. Take care of it. Make it quick, you know? I think that's why we get that story, is that the difference in the two. So, and then the last part, 47 to 52. Now the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw an army, any mighty man or any valiant man, he attached him to his staff. Once again, fulfilling what Samuel said to the Israelites, he's going to take your kids and he's going to bind you to oaths you don't want to. A lot of people will talk about how this is because of Saul's rash oaths. That if he would have let them eat, he would have destroyed the Philistines that day. If he would have not stopped that evening, they wouldn't have to stop to let everybody eat because they hadn't eaten all day. They could have pursued the Philistines even more and destroyed them. And then in the rest of it's 47, after Saul had assumed the rule over Israel, he fought against their enemies on every side, Moab, the Ammonites, Edom, the kings of Zobah, the Philistines. Whenever he turned, he inflicted punishment on them. He fought valiantly and defeated the Amalekites, delivering Israel from the hands of those who had plundered them. And then the end of it's going to talk about his family and go through that stuff. And 52, I have up here, all the days were war and he took all the people. So anything about chapter 14? I know as fast as I could do it in 35 minutes. And the next one is actually a little less heavy, but important still. Okay, chapter 15, Saul's disobedience and rebuke. And I almost wanted to put Saul's disobedience again and rebuke. So Saul's disobedience, Saul's order to destroy the Amalekites. I'm not going to go to the text so much because I do want to try to get as much of this in. Saul's order to destroy the Amalekites, they go in, and what do? Now, is he just told, hey, go fight the Amalekites, or you're going to go to war today? He says, you are going there to kill them and destroy all of their stuff, everything.
Do not spare them, but kill man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey.
Everything. Nothing left. Kill it all. What's that? Yeah, scorched earth. And there are historical reasons for that. Well, that's a whole nother class. So they spare Agag and the choice oxen and sheep. And this is one of my, this is a crisis of leadership, right? Because could Saul have said, no, do it, kill everybody, kill everything. And what would have happened? It probably would have happened. I think that they would have listened to Saul at this point still, and it would have happened.
They didn't need that honey when they were starving.
Yeah, if you're not going to do that, how bad would it be just to kill some extra people, right? And so remember that it's the people doing this. We don't have to see that Saul does, but it says Saul spared Agag, and the people took all the stuff, okay? So Samuel rebukes Saul. So Samuel is going to go confront Saul. Let me come up here. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel. This is in verse 10. It says, I regret that I have made Saul king because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions. Samuel was angry and he cried out to the Lord all that night. So Samuel confronts Saul and he says, the Lord bless, or when Samuel reached Saul, Saul said, the Lord bless you. I have carried out the Lord's instructions. But Samuel said, why do I hear sheep and oxen then? If you'd carry, like, I can only see him like sort of rolling his eyes, right? I had a kid today, I had to get in trouble, and I said, hey, did you do what I asked? I was working. Did you do what I asked? I was working. Did you do what I said? I was working. What I'd really told him was, turn around, face the wall, so you're not getting in trouble talking to everybody across from you. And he kept saying, I was like, that was providence that this kid tested me this way today, because I can see the same thing where he shows up. He's like, hey, I did it. And Samuel's like, oh, like, they're sheep right there, man. Like, why are you lying to me about this? And so Saul answered, the soldiers brought them from the Amalekites. They spared the best of the sheep and cattle to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but we totally destroyed the rest. We did everything but this. And what's interesting, he doesn't say we, he says who? The soldiers, right? He doesn't say it was me. He doesn't say we did this. He said they did this. That's another leadership thing. If the people under you mess something up, you mess something up. And that's a whole big deal there, right? Enough, said Samuel. Samuel said to Saul, let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. And Saul says, tell me. And he says, although you were once small in your own eyes, referring to when we met up with him the first time, he said, am I not a Benjamite? Why are you picking me, right? My father's house is small. The Lord anointed you king over Israel and sent you on a mission saying, go and completely destroy those wicked people, the Amalekites. Wage war against them until you have wiped them out. Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord? But I did obey the Lord, I went on the mission the Lord assigned me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites. So even then, Saul's making excuses, right? He's been confronted with his problems. And what is he saying? Yeah, and we're going to see this a little bit later when David's confronted with his sin. How's he going to react?
It was me.
Yeah, it was me. Like, oh, like that's one of my favorite lines. You are the man, except not in a good way. So, but we're doing this. The soldiers took the sheep and cattle and the plunder, the best of what was devoted. Like, I can see him just be like, but we took it. Like, this, like doing the whole, like, teenager thing, if you've had a teenager lately. But I did, right? Sort of whining about it. We're going to sacrifice it to the Lord, your God at Gilgal. Once again, his choice of words there is telling, right, about his mindset. He doesn't say our God. He says your God. And then Samuel's reply is worth reading. Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of the rams. For rebellion is like the sin of divination, and arrogance like the evil of idolatry. Because you have rejected the Lord of God, he has rejected you as king. So he says, you know what? Not only, like, he's already been told, I'm cutting off your seed. Now he's been told, what? He's rejecting you, not just your seed. Like, it was, the understanding in that verse is like, you know, we're going to at least let you finish your job here. But God's given up on you at this point. And that's got to sting a little bit, I think, for somebody who is displaying. I think if you got a psychiatrist to read this, he would be like, yeah, Saul's a narcissist at this point. He has narcissistic tendencies, which I don't see how anybody could be a king and not. So then there's a little back and forth, which I don't have time to get into, where he says, you know what, I've sinned, I violated the Lord's commands. Come with me, forgive me the sin, come back and worship with me, because he still wants to have the street cred of being connected to Samuel, right? And because the people still look at Samuel in respect, and having him there makes a big deal. So come with me. And he turns to go and he rips his clothing. He rips his a corner of his robe. And he says, the verses here, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you. He who is the glory of Israel does not lie or change his mind, for he is not a human being that he should change his mind. Which is an interesting glimpse into the ideas and the way that God works. And sort of one of those ideas of, we don't have to understand everything God does. He doesn't think like us because he's not us and we're not him, kind of thing. Then Samuel says, bring me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. Agag came to him in chains and he thought, and some of the verses say it, he will say, surely the bitterness of death has passed. So like, I just sort of, Agag is showing up and being like, we're friends now. It's cool. You saved me, because that's normally what you do. You save the king because they're rich and they pay off of bribery, bounty, and all that good stuff. And I'm sure he thinks he's safe. But Samuel said, as your sword has made women childless, so will your mother be childless among women. And this is one of those like moments I would love to see in the Bible, just to sort of see Agag be like, what? Like, whoa, where, how is this now? And then a theme throughout this book, once again, is then. This says, and Samuel put Agag to death before the Lord at Gilgal. The New American Standard reads it as, and Samuel hewn Agag in pieces. Hacked him in pieces, yeah. And that is, word choice matters when you're talking about killing people in the Bible. For instance, you know what slaughter means? Slaughter does not, like we think slaughter just means kill, right? Slaughter means specifically slit the throat. So if you said, oh, there's a great slaughter that day, they're slitting throats. Because it refers back to animals, and it's seen as an insult, because that's how you kill animals. A man, you'd chop his whole head off. Animals, you slaughter. And so that's the whole idea behind that. But I just think that's interesting, this last couple of verses here, where it says, then Samuel left for Ramah, and Saul went up to his home in Gibeah of Saul. Until the day Samuel died, he did not see Saul again. Though Samuel mourned for him, and the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. So that's it's interesting that Samuel and Saul have no other interactions after this.
Well, they do. After Samuel dies.
Well, yeah, okay. Until he dies. Sorry. Thanks for ruining it. I didn't know that. No. Yeah, say spoiler alert first.
Just a repeat of this.
Yeah. So that was a lot, and hopefully you got something out of that. I know I speed talked through most of it.
It's interesting that Samuel's old and he does this, and he gets up early in the morning to do God's will.
Yeah.
And he's the one who's faithful.
Yeah, and it just and it's just the idea of seeing him like be like, oh, where'd he get the sword? Like, did he do like a movie where he like takes somebody's sword from his belt and just like, I don't know. Could be, which is even more insulting that you get disarmed. So, thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate it.